Welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Friday, October 8th. I'm your reader, Dagna. We will begin with the mini editorial that's on the front page, and today's mini editorial is written by John Polifica of Sioux City. And John writes, in her mini praising Linda Holub's regulars column, the letter writer, as an afterthought, rued the prospect of the conservative voice being silenced. The letter writer has nothing to fear. She has the most powerful political organization in the country on her side. It's called, rather inaptly, Fox News. Again, this was written by John Polifica of Sioux City. Our first story is written by Nick Hytrek of the Sioux City Journal, and the headline is, Gift of Food is a Blessing. New Mobile Food Bank brings relief to Macy, Walt Hill, Macy, Nebraska. It's about 15 minutes before 11 a.m., and cars, pickups, and vans begin lining up down the street and around the corner from Our Lady of Fatima Catholic Church in Macy. Those inside the vehicles wait patiently while a dozen volunteers from Omaha fill boxes and sacks with canned food, meat, and bread, and unload boxes of fresh produce and diapers from a truck and van. Once the clock hits 11, Michaela Scholey waves the first pickup forward, collects the driver's name and family information, and instructs her to pull forward to pick up her free food and diapers and wipes if she has young children in her home. In a community noted for its high poverty rate, the gift of food is appreciated by everyone who drives through. Hello, thank you guys, God bless you, a man in a pickup says to Scholey after she tells him to pull ahead to receive his food. Since June, a new mobile food pantry run by Catholic Charities in Omaha has been a blessing to residents of Macy and Walt Hill, two Thurston County communities located on the Omaha Indian Reservation. On the first Tuesday of each month, the volunteers carpool the 70-some miles up from Omaha and distribute food they've collected from sources in Omaha and from the Food Bank of Siouxland in Sioux City. They spend 2 hours in Macy and another hour in Walt Hill, trying to address the county's high rate of food insecurity, defined as a lack of access to culturally appropriate and nourishing food. Sometimes family have to choose between safety and nourishment, and we're trying to alleviate that, said Scholey, Director of Emergency and Supportive Food Services at Catholic Charities. For many years, Catholic Charities has supported a food pantry in Walt Hill that is open for a couple of days later in the month. Scholey said it was obvious more aid was needed for Thurston County families. She said, we became aware of the level of vulnerability these individuals are experiencing on a daily basis just by visiting Walt Hill. For the past 2 years, Scholey and others worked to establish a mobile food pantry to visit the two communities. After securing the necessary resources, food supplies, and volunteers, the mobile food pantry made its first visit in June, distributing food to 100 families. The number rose to 170 in July and 200 in August, a total that represents about 1,000 people. The growing numbers are not only a sign of need, but the trust Catholic Charities has gained here. They've come each month, except September, when a rash of COVID-19 cases forced them to cancel, rather than making a one-time visit and never returning. Scholey said, I think the fact that we are coming consistently has had an impact on the community in gaining their trust. It's something they can rely on. During Tuesday's visit, volunteers enjoyed the warm, sunny fall morning while setting up, then carrying the food to open car doors and talking with local residents while they waited. It's nice to know that we can be better brothers and sisters, said Paula Lenz, a retired teacher from Omaha, as she pulled packages of diapers from boxes and handed them through car windows to thankful families. Tell your neighbors to come by. God bless you, Lenz called out to each driver as he or she pulled away. Judging by the increasing number of families each visit, Scholey said residents appear to be doing just as Len said, spreading the word to neighbors. Many here have no transportation, thus limiting their ability to access food. Scholey said she sees many drivers make repeat trips, bringing others who don't have transportation to the food pantry so they can receive a box too. The smiles on the faces of those who come makes the early morning drive up from Omaha and the late afternoon drive back again worth it, Scholey said. This community is the most gracious community to be part of and come to, she said. I've never experienced the level of gratitude I've experienced in Walt Hill and Macy. It's truly humbling. Though the mobile food pantry is still in its early stages, Schuler said that she continues to assess it. Expanding the service to more days or other communities is a possibility. She said, we're always open to opening and expanding to more avenues to help the community. Judging from the high turnout and the grateful expressions on the faces of the local residents receiving the food, they'd welcome any expansion with open arms and wide smiles. We now have a few brief stories. First one is local COVID cases fall. New COVID-19 infections continued to fall last week in Woodbury County, hitting the lowest level in over a month. The county reported 442 positive cases for the week beginning September 27, down from 525 the prior week, according to the latest weekly report released by Siouxland District Health. The 14-day positivity rate also tickled down from 16% to 15.7%. The number of people in Sioux City's two hospitals with COVID also fell sharply, from 42 during the week of September 20th to 33 last week. Last week's new positive cases were the fewest since the 313 reported for the week of August 30th. In more recent weeks, the high peaked at 541 new cases for the week starting September 13th. Siouxland District Health officials had attributed much of the spike to highly contagious Delta variant of the virus, which now appears to be waning. Despite repeated public calls to get shots, more than half of Woodbury County residents remain unvaccinated, according to state figures. As of the week of September 27th, 45.5% of the county residents had completed the single or two-dose vaccinations, little change from the previous week. Man pleads not guilty of pistol whippings. A Sioux City man has pleaded not guilty to two charges of pistol whipping two people in a Sioux City home and taking cash from one of the victims. Alexio Carriaga, 21, entered his plea Thursday in Woodbury County District Court to single counts of first-degree burglary, and two counts each of possession of a firearm by a domestic abuser, domestic abuse assault, felon in possession of a firearm, and domestic abuse assault, third offense. According to court documents, Carriaga went to his girlfriend's aunt's house on August 17th and demanded she give him money before he put a gun to the back of her head and hit her in the head twice with it. He left after she gave him the money. On August 19th, Carriaga went to a home in the 1600 block of 27th Street to see the woman and kicked in the back door, court documents said. The woman was there with a male friend, and Carriaga pistol whipped both of them in the head with a handgun, causing a gash on the woman's head. When police located Carriaga's car at 29th and Jackson Streets, an officer found a handgun on the floor and a fanny pack containing marijuana. Court records show Carriaga had two previous domestic abuse assault convictions. McCook Lake man sentenced on gun charge. A McCook Lake man who illegally purchased guns that he later traded for drugs was sentenced Wednesday to 4 years in federal prison. Brandon Christensen, 40, pleaded guilty in May in U.S. District Court in Sioux City to possession of a firearm in furtherance of a drug trafficking crime. According to the U.S. Attorney's Office, Christensen bought 56 firearms from February 6, 2013 to June 30, 2020 and lied about his drug use when buying them. He then traded the guns to drug dealers in exchange for drugs. During a June 29, 2020 search of his home, Christensen told authorities he was a gun collector, but no firearms were found in his possession. Purchase records confirmed that he had bought at least 23 firearms from five different stores in Sioux City and Sioux Falls. Five of them were recovered by authorities during unrelated drug investigations, and a sixth was recovered in another unrelated case. The last two nights has been the Broadway show Cats in downtown Sioux City, and we have a review by Bruce Miller. And the headline on this review is Cats Isn't Perfect, but it shows why we need live theater. And perfect, it was spelled P-U-R-R, F-E-C-T, a play on it being cats. The reason the film version of Cats was such a dud is simple. The musical is a creature of the theater. Taking it out of that element, where something as ridiculous as adults playing cats actually works, removes a reason for its very being. The point became abundantly clear Wednesday night at the Orpheum Theater, where the National Touring Company proved the plot is still thin. One cat is chosen to go to the heavy side layer, well, where a new life begins, but theatrically is off the charts. As a handful of cats make their pitch to get that second chance, songs explain who's in the running. Save from memory, Andrew Lloyd Webber's score isn't all that memorable. Still, there are enough diversions to make a night with cats much better than a night at home with cats. While bits have been paired here and there, the parade of contestants is still fascinating. John Ankerbow as Gus, the theatrical cat, had the most touching moment as he recalled a past on the stage. Shaking and proud, he made a good case for Gus's selection. Still, you couldn't beat Grizabella, the glamour cat, played by Taylor Harris, who got that signature song. Even though she had makeup that was more Norma Desmond than Faded Cat, Harris mined all of the emotion from memory. She was a fitting choice for the role, even though it's hardly as athletic as some of the others. Mr. Mistopheles, played by Paul Garitano, got a real workout, conjuring plenty of magic and doing it in a jacket that changed colors more than Joseph's amazing technical dream coat. Munxatrap, played by Devin McCleskey, held the show together as a narrator of sorts, and McCleskey was clearly this production's triple threat. And Victoria, played by Hyla Mayrose Perella, attracted attention every time she got center stage. Because it's early in this production's run, many of the dancers looked like they were more concerned with proficiency than feeling. They nailed Andy Blankenbuehler's revised choreography, but needed to infuse it with more emotion. In time, that will come. What needs a quick fix is the show's lighting. Often characters were stranded in darkness. Considering they're pulling off some neat moves, they needed to be seen. While the show's set was a hit and miss, it doesn't have the surprise factor of earlier editions, but its ascending tire is pretty spectacular. Its sound did not fail. Even some of the smallest voices were understandable. Because the stage isn't big enough for some of Trevor Nunn's original direction, moments got lost. When Skimbleshanks, the railroad cat, creates a train out of spare parts, it should be a wow moment. Instead, it seemed like a planned event. When old Deuteronomy arrived, he didn't quite have the presence needed to make the other cats cower. In time, Valentine seized authority and justified the deference. When he escorted the winner to the heavy side layer, the scene had real emotion. Cats may not be the ideal show to get folks back into theater, but it certainly demonstrated why the medium is so essential. There's enough meat on these bones to help anyone escape from a world that doesn't quite know how to settle down. Cats, now and forever. Why not? And I have a story from out of Florida about a giant snail, and as far as I know, it's not up here in Iowa, but I hope it never comes. So, headline is, Florida eliminates giant snail that can eat houses. It's an 8-inch master of disaster. A snail that can eat the stucco off your house and give you meningitis. But it's been eliminated from Florida. Again. Officials have announced that the giant African land snail has been eradicated from Florida for the second time. Florida Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried said, "This truly is an exciting day for our state and our country. In Florida, the African land snail existed largely in Miami-Dade County, although hundreds of the pests were found in Broward County, specifically Western Davie, in 2014. The snail is a threat on many levels, considering it carries a parasite that can cause meningitis in humans, eats 500 types of plants, and eats stucco. It'll eat your plants, and it'll eat your house," said Trevor Smith, director of the Division of Plant Industry and a Florida state plant regulatory official. "The snails could be brought here intentionally or unintentionally," Freed said, "and they have major implications when it comes to Florida's trade and exports. Our trade partners do not want this pest, Smith said. So it was absolutely imperative that we come in and eradicate this thing so it doesn't impact our international trade. The first giant African land snail was found near Douglas Park in Miami. In 1966, a child brought three to South Florida from Hawaii. His grandmother threw them out in the yard, and they reproduced by the thousands, but were eradicated by 1975. Smith says it's unclear how the recent wave of the snails got to Florida in 2011. A colony of the enormous mollusks was discovered in 2014 around a house in Western Davie. The snails come out when it rains, and they're most active at night. And they routinely bury themselves 6 to 8 inches in the soil, making them so tough to find, Florida had to train two dogs to sniff out the creatures. Since 2011, the state has collected more than 168,000 of the snails. Smith said to consider a species eradicated or eliminated, it must be 3 years since the last live one was spotted. The last live giant African land snail was reported in 2017. We'll now move to the opinion page, and we have no letters to the editor today, but we do have a opinion piece under Other Voices, and this one happens to be from Yankton Press and Dakotan. And the headline is, A Do-Over on South Dakota Social Studies Standards. Late last week, Governor Kristi Noem hit the reset button on an effort to revise South Dakota Social Studies standards after the end product of the recent process drew criticism from several sides, even from those who were tasked with crafting those standards. This most likely won't end the controversies, but for now, starting over is the best course. Since this effort began several months ago, one specter hovering over it was Noem's intent to come up with something that closely mirrored the 1776 project proposed by former President Donald Trump a year ago. The mission of that project was to, in effect, promote America's greatness while mostly glossing over some of the more problematic terrain, such as the role of racism in this country. The group tasked with writing South Dakota's new social studies standards began its work several months ago. According to former Yankton High School teacher Paul Herons, who was part of that group, they were told by the Department of Education, or DOE, representative that the state was criticized the last time the standards were redrawn for not being inclusive enough in terms of Native American culture and history. The DOE rep advised them, I would like to see every group have at least one standard for the Native Americans, Herons told the press in Dakotan. The group did its work with that in mind, he said, including the crafting of a preamble to serve as a mission statement for its efforts, and submitted the final document in late June. But when those proposed standards were released several weeks later, they had been greatly revised. Herons said only two sentences of the preamble had been kept, with the rest rewritten. Also, they eliminated, I think it was 3/4 of the Native American standards, he said. We were told to do one thing. We did it, and they took it away. That's why we were so shocked. Herons said efforts to find out who authorized those changes have made little headway. But he said the fact that the final document closely mirrors the 1776 project recommendations, which he said whitewashes U.S. history and massively skips over the indigenous population in the United States, likely offers some guidance. It's basically the 1776 projects or comments that Noem has made, Heron said. Somebody had to tell the Department of Education to make those changes, and it wasn't somebody in the Department of Education. I don't know who it was, but I can make a guess. The uproar over this has been quite strong, and Noem, who had earlier put a delay on the process, pulled the plug last week and announced a do-over. Our focus remains the same, the governor said, ensuring that South Dakota students learn a true and honest account of American and South Dakota history. But how it will be done over remains to be seen. Many education officials were unhappy with the final proposal issued, while some conservative entities have been critical of what was viewed as liberal efforts in crafting the document. Also, Noem took to social media recently and said radical education activists were trying to impose a left-wing agenda. Restoring honest and true American and South Dakota history in our schools won't be easy, but we must win, she said in words that were echoed in last week's statement. So you can see where this might be headed. It seems that the best place to start or restart this process is to follow the DOE's original advice, be inclusive. We can't shut the Native American aspect of the state's history to a back burner. Indigenous views need to be well represented in whatever group is formed to write those standards. We've made enough mistakes in education, Heron said. Let's not make another one. Revising the standards should be seen as an effort to cultivate some constructive honesty in the educational process, and that needs to be the mission going forward. And again, this was an opinion piece from the Yankton Press and Dakotan. We'll now have a COVID vaccination story, and the headline is Pfizer's request to okay shots for kids, a relief for parents. Parents tired of worrying about classroom outbreaks and sick of telling their elementary school-age children no to sleepovers and family gatherings felt a wave of relief Thursday when Pfizer asked the U.S. government to authorize its COVID-19 vaccine for youngsters ages 5 to 11. If regulators give the go-ahead, reduced-dose kid shots could begin within a matter of weeks. That could bring many families a step closer to being done with remote learning, virus scares, and repeated school shutdowns and quarantines. My son asked about playing sports. After you're vaccinated. He asked about seeing his cousins again. After you're vaccinated. A lot of our plans are on hold, said Sarah Stafir of Waterville, Maine, whose 70-year-old has a rare immune disease that has forced the family to be extra cautious throughout the pandemic. When he's vaccinated, it would give our family our lives back, she said. Expanding vaccine availability for roughly 28 million more U.S. children is seen as another milestone in the fight against the virus and comes amid an alarming rise in serious infections in youngsters because of the extra contagious Delta variant. It would also push the U.S. vaccination drive further ahead of much of the rest of the world at a time when many poor countries are desperately short of vaccine. The Food and Drug Administration must decide whether the shots are safe and effective in younger children. Many parents and pediatricians are clamoring for protection for youngsters under 12, the current cutoff for COVID-19 vaccinations in the United States. 9-year-old Audrey Mulder, who lives in the Philadelphia suburb of Drexel Hill, is looking forward to visiting her grandma without worrying she will give the older woman COVID. She's excited because she thinks it's a responsibility, said her father, Justin Mulder. She wants to keep her friends and family safe. Dr. Amanda Powell, an internist and pediatrician who runs a clinic in Portland, Maine, is eager to set up worry-free play dates and plan a family trip again once her 9-year-old son is vaccinated. She said, "We want to be able to resume some normal activities." But there are also plenty of parents who are wary about getting the shot themselves, are in no hurry to have their children vaccinated. Heather Miller, a mother of four from Dexter, Maine, said she wants to wait for follow-up studies on the vaccine. I'm not 100% against getting it eventually, but I kind of fall into the not right now category, she said. Cindy Schiller, an elementary school principal in West Virginia, which ranks dead last in the percentage of fully vaccinated residents, said it has been a rough start to the year because so many children are testing positive or quarantining at different times, making it hard for students and teachers to stay on track. Still, she said, she often hears parents say they are more concerned about the effects of the vaccine than COVID-19. She said some parents are all for it and getting it for peace of mind, but the majority of parents I've talked to will not be getting it. While kids are at a lower risk of severe illness or death than older people, COVID-19 does sometimes kill children. At least 520 so far in the United States, according to the American Academy of Pediatrics. Pfizer and its German partner BioNTech said their research shows younger children should get 1/3 of the dose now given to everyone else. After the second dose, the 5 to 11-year-olds develop virus-fighting antibody levels just as strong as those that teens and young adults get from regular strength shots. On October 26, an independent expert panel that advises the FDA will publicly debate the evidence. If the FDA authorizes emergency use of the kid-sized doses, The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention will make a final decision after hearing from its outside advisors. To avoid mix-up, Pfizer is planning to ship the lower dose vial specially marked for use in children. We'll now move to the Kathy Yoder article, and today's headline on her article is Authors' Experiences Teach the Value of Forgiveness. And Kathy Yoder is a devotional writer, and she may be reached at kathyyoder4@gmail.com. And she writes, first is a quote from Corrie ten Boom, "Never be afraid to trust an unknown future to a known God." I've admired Corrie ten Boom most of my life. Her first book, The Hiding Place, came out when I was in high school. A few years later, the movie of the same name was released. Corrie was a watchmaker like her father, Caspar ten Boom. She lived with her father and her sister Betsy in Holland. They were Christians who daily lived out their faith. Her dad loved the Jewish people, God's chosen people. In May 1940, Hitler took over the Netherlands, Belgium, and France. Within 6 months, anti-Jewish laws were established. Eventually, the Jewish people were put in ghettos, separated for simply being Jewish. They were ultimately taken by train to concentration and extermination camps. Three-fourths of the Jewish people living in the Netherlands were murdered in the Nazi Holocaust during World War II. Corrie and her family did not stand by watching this happen without acting. They soon became part of the Dutch underground resistance and hid Jewish people in their home. It's estimated that they helped 800 Jewish people escape. Eventually, Caspar, Corrie, Betsy, and other members of the family were betrayed to the Gestapo and taken to the camps. Caspar, 84, died in the Scheveningen prison. Corrie and Betsy were together in Ravensbrück concentration camp. Betsy died on December 16, 1944. Just days before her death, she told Corrie, "There is no pit so deep that he is not deeper still. They will listen to us, Corrie, because we have been here." 12 days later, Corrie was released from Ravensbrück. A week later, all the women in her age group were murdered. How did this happen? Corrie says that her name mysteriously moved from the death list to the freedom list. It was a clerical error, but Corrie knew that it could only be the Lord who made that change. Through the kindness of a rich woman, Corrie opened up a home for those who survived the camps. I read once that Corrie said the people who were able to forgive those who were so cruel to them were the ones who eventually left the home and moved on with their lives. The ones who could not forgive did not get better. Later, at age 53, Corrie became a tramp for the Lord, spreading the gospel all over the world. She traveled to more than 60 countries for 33 years. She shares God's hope and love with many. She often said that you can never learn that Christ is all you need until Christ is all you have. Corrie also talked about forgiveness. She was speaking in a church in Munich. Afterward, a man made his way to her. She remembered him. He was an SS man who stood guard at the shower door at the Ravensbrück Processing Center. A flashback came to Corrie. The mocking man, the humiliation, her sister Bessie's face. The former guard reached out to shake her hand. Corrie writes, "He came up to me as the church was emptying, beaming and bowing. 'How grateful I am for your message, Fräulein,' he said. 'To think that, as you say, he has washed my sins away.' He thrust his hand out to shake mine, and I, who so often preached the need to forgive, kept my hand at my side. The first time I read those words so many years ago, I thought to myself, 'Well, of course, you can't forgive a man like that.' I was wrong." Corrie writes, "Even as the angry, vengeful thoughts boiled through me, I saw the sin of them. Jesus Christ has died for this man. Was I going to ask for more? Lord Jesus, I prayed, forgive me and help me to forgive him." Still, Corrie could not raise her hand. She prayed another silent prayer, asking Jesus to give her his forgiveness. Then something amazing happened. Corrie writes, "As I took his hand, the most incredible thing happened. From my shoulder along my arm and through my hand, a current seemed to pass from me to him, while into my heart sprang a love for this stranger that almost overwhelmed me. And so I discovered that it is not on our goodness that the world's healing hinges, but on His. When He tells us to love our enemies, He gives, along with the command, the love itself. The Lord not only commands us to love our enemies, He also supplies the love. We simply have to ask. It sounds so simple, but it's life-changing. It can change the world. Are you holding on to unforgiveness? Are you unable to forgive yourself or others who've harmed you? Does bitterness grow inside you? Maybe you feel justified in your unforgiveness. Corey was surely justified in hers, and yet she knew it was a sin to harbor it. For if you forgive men when they sin against you, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you do not forgive men their sins, your Father will not forgive your sins. This is from Matthew 6, verses 14 and 15. Knowing that she could not forgive on her own, she asked the Lord to help her. He did. She not only forgave her former jailer, the Lord gave her a great love for him. Let's let go of unforgiveness, of hatred, of bitterness today. Ask the Lord to remove it from you. He will. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Friday, October 8th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. We'll now turn to today's obituaries. And the first one is Mary Therese Lennon, 65, of Omaha, formerly of Sioux City, passed away peacefully on Friday, September 17th, lovingly surrounded by her family after suffering complications from a stroke. Following a private family mass of Christian burial, Therese will be laid to rest at Calvary Cemetery in Sioux City. Therese was born on April 19, 1956, in Sioux City, to Dr. John and Shuivan Dodery. She graduated from Bishop Heelan High School in 1974 and then went on to earn a registered nursing degree from Western Iowa Tech. Therese loved being a nurse and had a special gift for taking care of others, especially when they were most in need. Always fearless and a free spirit, she brought adventures and fun to those around her. She was a beloved sister and aunt who will be greatly missed. Therese especially loved spending time with her dog, Dylan. She was formerly married to Charles Lennon. In lieu of flowers, donations may be sent to the Carmelite Monastery at 2901 South Cecilia Street, Sioux City, 51106. Charlotte Louise Krug Petty, 88, of Brunswick, Georgia, formerly of Sioux City, passed away Monday, October 4th at Hospice of the Golden Isle. At her request, no services will be held. Charlotte was born May 23, 1933, in Atkins, Iowa, to Clarence John and Abigail Harnish Krug, and lived most of her life in Sioux City. Charlotte never missed a day during her first 12 years of school and was salutatorian of her graduating class. She graduated from Morningside College in Sioux City and received her bachelor's degree from the University of Nebraska. Charlotte had a fulfilling career as a teacher and principal in the Iowa school system. Charlotte led an adventurous life and loved camping. She was an accomplished water skier, loved swimming, kayaking, boating, motorcycling, yes, she rode her own, and flying in her family's private airplane. She was an artist with crafts and sewing. Charlotte touched countless lives, many complete strangers, with her handcrafted candy boxes, greeting cards, sewn bags for military, and backpacks for kids. She was active in the church, commissioned as a Stevens minister, and was certainly a humbling, caring, loving, and giving person. Bye for now, as she would always say. Ernest M. Schmidt, 90, of Sergeant Bluff, passed away Wednesday, October 6th, at a local assisted living. Private services were held. Waterbury Funeral Service of Sergeant Bluff is assisting the family with arrangements. Ernie was born on September 12, 1931, the son of Henry and Hildegard Schmitz. Ernie married Barbara Decker on September 13, 1958. He worked and traveled for Swift & Company for 31 years while raising their family until the closing of Swift & Company in Sioux City. They later settled in Sergeant Bluff. Ernie enjoyed in his younger years fishing, hunting, and anything he could tinker with in his garage. After retirement, Ernie and his wife were snowbirds and traveled to Arizona for the winter months. They followed their grandkids to sporting activities and other events. Glenn Fuller, Paulina, Iowa, 78, died Wednesday, October 6th. Graveside services will be October 10th at 1 p.m. at the Prairie View Cemetery in Paulina. Visitation will be October 10th from 1:30 to 3:30 at the First Presbyterian Church. Arrangements with the Eldridge Family Funeral Home in Paulina. Shirley Beatrice Perkins Ellison, 88, of Sioux City, passed away Monday, October 4th on her family farm, surrounded by her family. A celebration of life will be held at Country Celebrations Event Center on Sunday. Visitation will be held at 2 p.m. and service at 3 p.m. Arrangements are under the direction of Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Shirley was born March 16, 1933, in Sioux City to George and Beatrice Heiser Perkins. Proud to be the fourth generation to live and work on her family farm, she spoke fondly of her cows and pigs that she raised. She was a passionate about 4-H, where she was both a member and a leader for many years, speaking often of her many demonstrations and sewing projects. On September 14, 1963, she married Charles F. Ellison in Sioux City. They were blessed with 3 children. Shirley and Charles enjoyed hosting their Christmas open houses and countless other parties. Memorials may be sent to Meyer Brothers Funeral Home. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to the Peer Center for Autism. William Bill Mulder, Orange City, 95, died Monday, October 4th. Services will be October 13th at 10:30 a.m. at the First Reformed Church in Morris. The burial will be after the service at Sherman Township Cemetery in Morris. Visitation will be October 13th from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. at the church. Arrangements with the Ullman Family Home in Orange City. Ronald D. Muth, Ireton, Iowa, 71, died Tuesday, October 5th. Services will be October 9th at 10:30 a.m. at the Associated Church in Haywarden. Burial will be at the Pleasant View Cemetery in Ireton. Visitation will be October 8th from 2 to 7:30 p.m. at the Porter Funeral Home in Ireton. Marjorie J. Sanderson, Sioux City, 57, died Wednesday, October 6th. Arrangements are pending with the Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City. We'll now move to the sports section, and our first story will be a Week 7 Metro Football Preview. So we'll begin with Boyden Hall and Sergeant Bluff Luton. When Boyden Hall, Rock Valley, and Sergeant Bluff Luton High School football teams met last year, it was an instant classic. The two teams, both ranked in this week's Class 3A Associated Press High School football poll, meet again Friday night in Sergeant Bluff. The Nighthawks are second in the 3A poll, while the Warriors are eighth. Last season, the Warriors won in a 42-35 Week 3 nail-biter, and the difference in that game was a 3-yard run by quarterback Tyler Smith, with 3 seconds left to hold off the Nighthawks. SBL grad Caden Held had 5 touchdowns, including a crucial touchdown with 2 minutes 32 seconds remaining. That was a 5-yard touchdown reception on third down from Smith. But the Nighthawks had an answer, which led to Smith's eventual game-winning score. Boyden Hall Rock Valley needed 7:30 and 10 combined plays to score those 2 touchdowns. Landon Van Kekerex had 9 catches for 131 yards and a touchdown. Caleb Katz was the quarterback last year for the Nighthawks, and he had a 17 of 34 night for 217 passing yards. Both teams won the following week. The Warriors have won the last 6 meetings against the Nighthawks. So then the next game highlighted is Urbandale at West at 7 p.m. on Friday. The Wolverines will host the 6th-ranked Jayhawks at Olsen Stadium on Friday night. The Jayhawks have won their last 3 games against Des Moines Roosevelt, Des Moines East, and a 1-point win over Ankeny Centennial. The Jayhawks haven't allowed more than 18 points in the last 5 weeks. This is the last road game that Urbandale will play in the regular season. Meanwhile, the Wolverines are trying to end a 3-game losing streak. They lost in a close 27-21 game against the Scarlets last week. Their other two losses were not so close ones against Council Bluffs Lincoln and Waukee Northwest. Drew Benson isn't too far away from the 1,000-yard mark as a rusher. He has 922 yards and 114 carries. Devin Fry has 440 passing yards and 35 completions. West will play at Olsen Stadium for the last 3 weeks. Next week, it will be on the home team against North. Then it will go to the road sideline in the October 22nd season finale against East. Then our next game is East at Des Moines East, and it will be 7 p.m. on Friday. As mentioned above, the Scarlets edged the Wolverines 27-21 last week. Des Moines East scored in the fourth quarter to earn its second win of the season. Darius Sirleaf has 328 rushing yards and 74 carries. He has one catch for 96 yards, which turned out to be a touchdown. The Scarlets have 692 total rushing yards and 598 passing. The Black Raiders, meanwhile, are needing a win in the worst way. They're riding a 3-game losing streak with losses to Waukee Northwest, Ankeny Centennial, and SBL. They haven't won in nearly a month, which was a 42-13 victory against Lamar's on September 10th. Sioux City East needs 157 rushing yards as a team to reach the 1,000 mark. And our next one preview is North at Johnston. That will be 7 p.m. on Friday. A win would clinch a winning regular season for the Stars as they sit at 4-2 heading into Week 7. The Stars grinded out a 21-18 win over Waukee last week and found themselves with a chance to beat a third Central Iowa team this season. The Stars need 154 rushing yards to break 1,000 as a team. They've had 7 different rushers and 3 with 39 or more carries. Dedrick Sullivan leads the Stars' rushing attack with 346 yards. This week's Metro Athlete of the Year, Desmond Grace, has 38 total tackles, with 31 of them being unassisted. And then our next one is Bishop Heelan at Sioux Center, again at 7 p.m. tonight on Friday. The Crusaders play their final road game of the regular season, but it's against a team that received votes earlier in this season's AP poll. The Crusaders are coming off a 23-22 loss to Carroll last week. Sir Brandon Watts has 12 carries on 90 yards as a rusher. Sophomore quarterback Quinn Olson was 6 for 18 for 76 yards and a touchdown in the loss to the Tigers. The Tigers scored 16 points in the second quarter while they held Heelan scoreless. And then it's Sioux Falls Christian at Dakota Valley, 7 p.m. Friday. The Panthers have lost 3 of their last 4 games, including a 36-13 defeat to Millbank. The Chargers and Panthers played last season, with the Chargers winning a 24-23 nail-biter. Despite the loss, Dakota Valley amassed 358 yards to Sioux Falls Christian's 324. The Panthers had 319 rushing yards. And then Omaha Roncalli at South Sioux at 7 p.m. on Friday. The Cardinals return home to face Roncalli, which has just 2 wins on the season. We now have a column by Barry Pohl, and the headline is Mitchell Donaldson Claimed Top Honor. A very good golfer recently offered some sage advice. It went something like this. Do we play golf to win? Heck no. Every other sport you hopefully win at least half the time. Golf, maybe once a year. We play golf for the camaraderie and togetherness, to spend an afternoon on the course with your buddies. And if the breaks don't go your way, you practice and do it again next year. A perfect example is this year's Sioux City Journal Siouxland Player of the Year, Colin Mitchell. Despite not recording a victory, the 37-year-old Mitchell played solid enough to garner enough points through a season-long competition to claim this year's top honor. Meanwhile, Jeff Donaldson returned to a familiar spot as Siouxland Senior Player of the Year, although it came down to the final round of the final tournament of the season for him to edge reigning Senior Player of the Year Sam Prue. I take it as a good accomplishment, but it's strange not to have a cornerstone victory, Mitchell said, but it was generally pretty consistent, close but no cigar. I played just to have a chance to win, which is what I'm trying to do anyway. I had a couple of chances. A bulky back may have cost the Sioux Citian his best chance of victory. Mitchell trailed by one shot heading into the final round of the Interstate Amateur, but he tweaked his back at home before the start of Sunday's play and was unable to play at 100%. The UPS driver posted top 10 finishes in each of the events he played in. In the past, the North High School graduate has had some difficulties controlling his emotions on the course. I may have been one to pack it in the past, but I'm kind of past that, Mitchell said. You never know what's going to happen. You just play your best on every shot and take what you get as opposed to thinking you're maybe entitled to doing it better than what you're doing. It's a process. I've had little success in the last... I'm sorry, let me start that sentence again. I've had a little success in the last 3 or 4 years, so I think I finally have something to show for the big picture. You don't get to play golf very much, so you make the most out of what you get. At one point, golf was going to be Mitchell's life. He gave up his amateur status to become an assistant professional at Green Valley, but after a few years in the business, decided to return to amateur golf. Mitchell won the 2018 Rick Collins Toyota Men's City Championship and has captured 4 straight Green Valley Club Championships. Brian Evans edged Josh Wendling in a close race for second in the Player of the Year standings, 720 to 715. Mitchell accumulated 892.5 points. Tri-State Masters Championship Johnny Spellberg from Bennington, Nebraska wound up fourth, and Matt Pitts of Cherokee was fifth. Mitchell said, I was kind of scoreboard watching this weekend. I know there were a couple of guys who could have passed me, but it just barely worked out that way. I think if Brian or Josh would have made the finals, they would have had their milestone victory. Donaldson, the owner of Sun Valley Golf Course in Sioux City, had to defeat Prue 3-2 in the championship match of the Dividend Cup Leo Division to claim his third Senior Player of the Year honor. It's amazing how it always comes down to the Dividend, Donaldson said. Sam is a tough competitor and had a fantastic year. The 61-year-old Prue emerged as champion on a windy Sunday in June in the Interstate Amateur. He also won the Siouxland Senior Open and scored a decisive 9-shot win in the Senior Men's City. I definitely felt like I was the underdog in the Dividend Championship match, Donaldson said. I think that kind of took some of the pressure off. Instead of being the favorite, I felt like I was the underdog, and that helped. Donaldson, 54, finished third in this Tri-State Masters and won the Rivercade Senior Crown. He was also a top 5 finisher in the City and Siouxland Senior Open. When the dust cleared, Donaldson had 1,277.5 points, and Prue had 1,273. That, however, isn't the closest Senior Player of the Year race he has been involved in, having tied a few seasons ago with close friend Bill Mathers. Vern Van Persum, Pat Mathers, and Jay Jackson rounded out the top 5 in the Senior Player of the Year standings. I knew there was only one way I could win Player of the Year, and that was win the Dividend Cup, Donaldson said. In the last 3 matches, I did not have one birdie, and I never saw the 18th hole. I just made a lot of pars, and you know, that's a good thing to do there. We would personally like to thank all of those who took part in the tournaments this season. Without that, there would be no Player of the Year race, which generates plenty of weekly conversations. We would also be remiss not to mention Jim LeMoyne, who is in charge of breaking down the plethora of numbers and providing season-long updates. Jim does this as a labor of love for the game of golf. He's a pretty fair linkster himself. In fact, he and yours truly paired for a victory in the Great Plains Senior Tour stop at Prairie Rose Golf Course in Brunsville earlier this summer. Hard to believe, another golf season is coming to a close. As usual, it sped by rather quickly. We're looking forward to another great season of competition in 2022, beginning with the Elk Point Early Bird in May. We'll now have some sports briefs. The first one is no game Friday for Musketeers. Due to mechanical issues with the ice rink at Walston Arena, the Omaha Lancers home opener scheduled for Friday has been postponed. Omaha is working to resolve the issue and will announce a rescheduled date when confirmed. The Musketeers next play on Saturday at Fargo. They'll return home Friday, October 22nd, against Tri-City. USD Slaughter named senior class nominee. South Dakota fifth-year senior Sammy Slaughter has been selected as one of 30 candidates who excel both on and off the court for the 2021 Senior Class Award in Collegiate Volleyball. Slaughter is one of two Summit League athletes selected among the 30 candidates, which includes Denver's Tina Bowe. Slaughter, a two-time All-Summit League first-team selection, is second on the team in kills per set at 2.62. Slaughter had a career-high 22 kills in the Coyotes' most recent match, a 5-set win over Kansas City. She has contributed 10 solo blocks and 24 block assists. Slaughter, who graduated with a degree in marketing in the spring, is currently pursuing a master's degree in interdisciplinary studies. Off the court, the Harrisburg, South Dakota native is peer mentor on campus and helps, along with the volleyball team, at the Ronald McDonald House in Sioux Falls. We now have prep cross country. Dakota Valley High School senior Blake Schmidt was the fourth place finisher Thursday at the Dakota 12 conference in Del Rapids. Schmidt was the highest placing runner in the area, running the 5,000 meter course in 17 minutes 38 seconds. Sioux Falls Christian senior Patrick Vogel won the conference in 17:01. Elk Point Jefferson sophomore Joe Cross led the Huskies with an 8th place finish of 17:41. Vermilius Joel Dahlhoff placed right behind Cross by about 2 seconds. Panthers freshman Jack Brown rounded out the top 10 in 17:50. The Chargers won the team title with 19 points. The Tanagers were 3rd, Panthers 4th, and Huskies 9th. The Chargers also took the top 3 spots in the girls' race. Ellie Maddox won the meet in 19:06. Vermilion sophomore Taylor Barda was 4th, and Tanager's 8th grader Lydia Anderson was 6th, and Callie Radigan was 7th. Sophia Redler led the Panthers with a 19th place, and Husky senior Claire LaFerre was 20th. Then the Fort Dodge girls' meet. The East senior Kaya Downs placed 5th Thursday at the Fort Dodge Invite with a time of 18:38. She placed behind 3 Class 4A girls she will likely see at the state meet later this month. West Des Moines Valley had the top 2 spots, led by sophomore Addison Dornkamp and Cameron Ensley. Ankeny freshman Allie Mackey was 4th, placing 5 seconds ahead of Downs. Downs was ranked 2nd in this week's Class 4A girls poll, ahead of Dornkamp and Ensley. Mariah Mora placed 2nd among East runners with a 156th place time of 22:48. Bishop Heelan placed 16th in the team standing, scoring 409 points. Brooklyn Stanley placed 36th with a time of 20:24. Fort Dodge boys meet. For the 2nd straight meet, North's junior Gabe Nash led the Stars pack, and again it led on to a Stars team win. On Thursday, North scored 41 points. Nash ran the 5,000 meter course at Lakeside in a time of 15:38. Senior Will Lohr placed 3 seconds behind his teammate. And we have time for one Dear Abby letter. Dear Abby, my husband and I have been happily married for 10 years. This is a second marriage for both of us. We don't have children together, but my husband has grown daughters in their 50s from a previous marriage. Generally, we have good relationships with each other. My problem is, my husband still calls and refers to his daughters by their childhood nicknames, Peanut and Poopsie. They reciprocate by calling him silly names instead of dad or father. Seeing these adult women reverting to childhood drives me up a wall. They talk and act like little girls and use baby talk with each other. I have shared with my husband more than once that this innocent nickname game keeps his daughter stuck in old childhood patterns, while keeping other family members out of the conversation. How would you suggest I handle this? Signed, Feeling Like an Outsider. And Abby responds, Because you have shared with your husband more than once that you feel sidelined when his daughters do this and nothing has changed, try this. Arrange to visit with friends or schedule an activity you enjoy while your husband's girls visit their daddy. If you do, it may be less frustrating than trying to change them. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Friday, October 8th. I'm your reader, Dagna. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you so much for listening.